Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us, bringing us the news. Today's program, we're going to be speaking with Professor Gary L. Francione. We're going to talk about his new book called Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. It's a collection of different essays that he's published, and it's a very compelling and lucid read. Look forward to talking with him at about quarter after. I should mention a couple of housekeeping items. We have a bunch of new programs on the Animal Voices website, including an interview with Matthew Brower, Dr. Matthew Brower. We talked about wildlife photography and the legacy of colonialism and masculinity and this notion of camera hunting. It was a really interesting conversation. That's archived on our website, animalvoices.ca. We have the recent interview, too, about the pig rescue that happened with Farm Sanctuary and some other animal organizations. Of course, there was also the Vegetarian Food Fair interview with Mishka Alarcon. I know some people were doing searches for the Vegetarian Food Fair and were coming up with the 2006 show, so I hope that people didn't get confused with the dates. We got some email where people were a little bit unsure about the dates from 2006, but of course it was in 2008, and this Vegetarian Festival just happened over the weekend, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A lot of fake meat happening there. We have a bunch of other interviews, too. I think we have about 248 interviews at this point on our website, animalvoices.ca. We'd love to hear from you if you have any ideas for upcoming shows. We're always open to your feedback, or if you have any critiques of this program, you can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And without further ado, I will turn it over to Carl.
Thanks, Lauren. The news today, first piece of news coming to us all the way from pretty much right around the world, the China Post. The headline is, Manga Artists Join Forces to Promote Animal Rights. Seven renowned local manga artists will auction their original works online from September 12th to October 15th to raise awareness of animal rights in Taiwan, organizers said yesterday. The Asia Manga Cultural Association and Taiwan Institute of Renewable Energy announced that all profits from the sale will be donated to the Animal Protection of the Republic of China, Taiwan, which will commission the top illustrator for a special comic strip on promoting animal rights. The participating artists are Moody, Qing Yi, Yi She Sang Lian, Tsang Jianhua, Huang Yaoji, Cheng Dongting, and Max Huang. The charity event is held within the framework of the second National Student Manga Competition, which kicked off August 1st. The competition deadline is October 5th. This year, young aspiring artists in elementary school, high school, and university are invited to reflect on the role of animals in Taiwan society. Quote, the manga competition first aims at nurturing young talents, said Max Huang, chairman of Asia Manga, who noted that Taiwan has been confronted with a decreasing number of manga artists in recent years. Manga comics, a Japanese word for their uniquely styled print cartoons, are widely read in Taiwan by people of all ages. The pocket-sized manga books broach on a wide range of subjects, including action-adventure, sports, sentimental romance, science fiction, historical drama, fantasy, horror, sexuality, and business. Quote, drawing allows youngsters to express their feelings, explained famous manga artist Moody. Indeed, young manga artist Claire Huang used one of her recent comic strips depicting with good humor the story of the three little pigs to tell of her interest in animals. Quote, I like drawing animals because I cannot keep a pet at home, said the talented 11-year-old girl who drew the top prize in the first National Student Manga Competition held in 2007. And for more information on that, your best bet is probably to just Google Asia Manga Cultural Association to find a link to that story. And the next story coming to us from CBC News. The headline is, Quebec reports first listeriosis death recalls 11 cheeses. The Quebec government has ordered the recall of 11 cheeses because they may contain the Listeria bacterium. The province said Saturday that one person has died and 11 others were sent to hospital because of listeriosis. Health officials said there could be as many as 24 cases. Eight of the recalled products were made by the dairy Médard de Saint-Gédéon in the Lac Saint-Jean area. They were packed after July 12th. The Fromagiers de la Table Ronde in Saint-Sophie made the other three cheeses. They were recalled Thursday and were packed after July 14th. The CBC's French language arm, Radio-Canada, reported Thursday that the government had launched a special investigation of certain Quebec dairy factories. The Quebec death and infections are not yet reflected in the national totals. The Public Health Agency of Canada website said that as of late Friday, there were 38 confirmed listeria cases, 20 suspected, and 13 confirmed deaths. In Quebec, it said there were 2 confirmed cases, 9 suspected, and no deaths. There was one death being investigated in Quebec, it reported. And from the Austria Times, one of the best pieces of news I've heard in a while, the headline is, Banged Up Campaigners Released. Austria's state prosecution have ruled that the animal rights protesters imprisoned without charge by the government for over 100 days are to be released. The state prosecution explained that the government had run out of time and were no longer entitled to keep the campaigners locked up whilst it tried to build a case against them. Eric Habitzel, spokesman for the state prosecution in Wiener Neustadt, said that the release of the 9 campaigners has no effect on the ongoing investigations and that the evidence will now be checked to find out whether there will be a trial or not. After being released, Dr. Martin Balak, the head of the group, said that he cannot understand at all why he was detained. Balak had already announced he will continue campaigning for tortured animals. Balak, who worked alongside physicist Stephen Hawking for 8 years at Cambridge University, said, quote, I am not a criminal. Everything I did is 100% legal. I did not destroy anything. I did not cause or incite any violence. I would do everything I did exactly the same again. Yesterday, Greens Party boss Alexander van der Balen asked Balak to run as an independent candidate for the party in the 28th September election. One of the 10 accused activists had been released on the 13th of August, while the other 9 have been kept in detention until today, which I believe was last Tuesday. So that is great news for us. We've been following that story for a long time. And we send our best wishes to all the activists who were there and who have been released. And we're going to try, I believe, to get someone from the VGT back on the show to talk about that. And the final story today coming from WSFA.com. The headline is, A Look at Alabama's 8-Year-Old Beefed Up Animal Cruelty Law. Alabama lawmakers put more teeth in animal cruelty law 8 years ago. Is it working? It is always a shocking thing to see. A defenseless dog abused like the one in Monroe County, an 8-month-old puppy allegedly dragged a half mile by a man driving a stolen 3-wheeler. Quote, man's inhumanity to man is what I think of. I've never seen this done on purpose, said Monroeville veterinarian Dr. John Grider, who is treating the Rottweiler mix. Therein lies the rub. The new animal cruelty law approved 8 years ago was designed to severely punish those who deliberately torture animals. And yet today there seems to be no collective data to show how many people statewide have been convicted on the new law or how many have been given the maximum 10-year sentence. In Montgomery County, there have been 36 convictions this year alone, and the sentencings have ranged from suspended jail time to community service. So much depends on the facts of each case and to what degree the animal was abused, according to Montgomery Humane Society Executive Director Stephen Tears. Those convicted on the first-degree animal cruelty charge are eligible for the 10-year sentence. The second-degree charge is considered a misdemeanor. Quote, it's a proven fact that people who abuse animals will hurt people, Tears said. That's why Tears thinks in many cases, jail time would not be appropriate if you can educate suspects early about compassion and the proper care of animals. Quote, you put them in jail with other convicts and they won't come out as better people, said Tears. But make no mistake, Stephen Tears supports the new version of the law. The case involving Louis Vuitton, not the fashion designer but the pit bull, intentionally set on fire by his owner after the man's family wouldn't let him drive the family car. The beefed-up law is expected to come into play if Juan Daniels is convicted. Right now, Daniels remains in Montgomery County, and a trial date hasn't been set. Louis, in the meantime, is with a foster family at an undisclosed location and is expected to be used as evidence in Daniel's trial. And that is the news.
Great. Thanks, Carl. I think we're going to take a short musical break. We'll come back with Gary Francione to talk about his new book, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. Please stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to the show. Today we're speaking with Gary L. Francione, who's a distinguished professor of law, and Nicholas D. Katzenbach, scholar of law and philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law, Newark. He teaches in the areas of human rights, animal rights theory and the law, criminal procedure, jurisprudence, and legal philosophy. Notably, Francium was the first scholar to teach animal rights theory in an American law school. An abolitionist, he is best known within the animal movements for his rejection of animal welfare and his critiques of animals' property status. His books include Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, Rain Without Thunder, The Ideology of the Animal Rights Movement, Animals, Property, and the Law, Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide to Conscientious Objection. And today we'll be speaking with Francione about his newest text, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, which is published by Columbia University Press. It is my great pleasure, as always, to have Professor Francione on the line with us today. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So tell us about the new book, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. Can we start off with maybe what you mean by persons?
Well, yeah. I don't mean that they're human persons. I mean that they're members of the moral community, that when we consider their interests, we have to apply the principle of equal consideration, which is the foundational principle of all moral theories, of treat like cases alike. And we have to recognize that however different non-humans may be from humans, and obviously when we talk about non-humans, we're talking about a lot of different sorts of non-humans, some of whom will be more similar to humans than others. And my argument is there, my position is that it doesn't really matter how similar they are to humans. All that matters is if they're sentient, they ought to be full members of the moral community, and we have a moral obligation not to treat them as our resources, and that means that we have to abolish institutionalized animal exploitation.
That's a very succinct description. Tell us about what this book does that's perhaps maybe different or makes a different intervention than your work before. It's a collection of essays.
Yeah, it's a collection of essays. I mean, I'm trying to do several things with these essays. One is I'm trying to present my theory of animal rights, which rests, as I mentioned before, only on sentience. No other cognitive characteristic is required. So I reject this whole notion that great apes are deserving of greater legal and moral protection than, say, dogs or fish. So the first thing I'm doing is trying to describe my theory of animal rights, which rests only on sentience, and I do that in the first chapter. And I also, in the chapter Taking Sentience Seriously, which I think is the third chapter, Taking Sentience Seriously, also deals with the importance of sentience and how, as a historical matter, sentience assumed a certain importance in 19th century welfarist thought, but because the welfarists did not believe that animals have an interest in continued existence, they thought that the only thing that we needed to do was to improve the treatment of animals and not challenge the overall use of animals, and I discussed that idea in Chapter 3. Chapter 4 also deals with equal consideration and the interest of non-humans in continued existence. It sort of carries that analysis forward a little bit in the context of responding to Professor Cass Sunstein at the University of Chicago, mm-hmm. who did a review, a very, very lengthy review of Introduction to Animal Rights, which is the book I wrote in 2000. He did a review in a magazine.
Can I stop you there just for a second
sure.
before we go through them? Can you describe what you mean by sentience?
Yes, perceptual awareness. Just basically ability to feel pain, ability to be perceptually aware, to perceive the world around oneself. As far as I'm concerned, that's the only thing that's necessary for being a member, having membership in the moral community. And there are going to be areas, Lauren, where we're not going to really know whether an animal is sentient, for example, or whether a non-human is sentient. In the case of insects, for example, I think that there's still the jury's out on that question. I mean, I certainly don't kill them, not intentionally at least, and I try to avoid harming them, but I don't know if they're sentient. But all of the animals that we routinely exploit, fish and many sea animals and aquatic animals, chickens and pigs and cows, and basically everything we routinely exploit is sentient, and unquestionably so. So what I'm doing in chapters 1, 3, and 4 is really sort of working through a theory of animal rights that rests on sentience. In some of the other chapters, there's one chapter that deals with biomedical experimentation. There's another chapter, a very long chapter, that deals with the problems of animal welfare. What I do in that second chapter is I look at animal welfare reform over the past 10, 12 years since I wrote Animals, Property, and the Law and Rain Without Thunder, and I address my critics who say, well, yeah, there are problems with the property status of animals, but we can still have animals being property, but we can really make significant advances in animal welfare reform. And I basically review what those reforms are and argue that they don't do anything, really, to provide any increased protection for animal interests. What they do is make the public generally more comfortable with animal exploitation, because the public believes that exploitation is occurring more humanely, and that makes people feel better about exploiting animals and consuming animal products. There's a chapter in there about ecofeminist theory, because I think that has been misunderstood in a lot of ways, at least some aspects of ecofeminist theory, which, I mean, the idea that we can really have meaningfully change things without a concept of rights, or that rights are patriarchal, inherently patriarchal, are ideas that I analyze, I address, and I reject, because I do not think that I don't even understand what it means to say that rights are inherently patriarchal, and I'm not sure that people who make that argument understand it either. But I don't think the argument works, and I think that we need a concept of rights. We need a non-consequentialist, a deontological notion like rights or whatever else you want to call it, but we need the idea that certain actions and certain forms of exploitation are ruled out from the beginning once you're talking about moral persons. We have that, for example, when we talk about slavery. However, whatever disagreement we may have as a society about what rights humans have, we all accept that all human members of the moral community, that we can't treat any of them as chattel slaves. I mean, everybody agrees with that. That's not to say chattel slavery doesn't exist, but nobody defends it, and it's condemned when it's found to exist. So I make the same argument in response to the ecofeminists, who say we don't need rights when we're talking about animals, and indeed rights are patriarchal, because, you know, all of the feminists would say, for example, that rape is ruled out from the beginning. It's a form of violence, it's a form of exploitation, it's a form of commodification. It's not a question of whether rape is performed with care or how rape is performed. It is conduct which is ruled out from the beginning, the moment you recognize that women are full members of the moral community. And I say that the same thing applies when we're talking about non-human animals, that the treatment of animals as property is ruled out from the beginning. And that's a rights-type argument, and whatever you want to call it, that's a rights argument. And what I argue is the ecofeminists accept that as well. They just don't apply it in the context of non-humans, and I argue that's speciesist. And then there's an essay that deals with Tom Reagan's hypothetical in his book about the dog in the lifeboat, and Reagan basically argues that death is a greater harm for humans than it is for non-humans. And I basically reject that position and say that I don't know what death is for a non-human. I'm not sure I understand what it means for all other humans, because we have this problem of reading each other's minds. But I reject the notion that death is not as great a harm for non-humans as it is for humans. Mm. And I think that position, it undermines Reagan's view. And what that reflects, the fact that Reagan accepts that notion, and so does Singer, even though Singer's a consequentialist utilitarian, right, and Reagan is a sort of a Kantian rights thinker who very explicitly rejects Singer's consequentialism. Both of them accept the notion that animal minds are different from human minds, and that animals don't have, I mean, Singer argues that most animals don't have an interest at all in continuing to exist, so it's not a question of that we're using them, it's only a question of how we're using them. Whereas Reagan equivocates more on that, and Reagan certainly does not think we should be exploiting animals, but he has this idea that in situations of conflict, animals have to lose because humans have a greater interest in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that undermines Reagan's argument in lots of ways, and that's what one of the chapters deals with. But that's basically a synopsis.
Okay, that's great. I was wondering if you would do us the service of taking us back maybe to the beginning of your journey with these issues, because I've realized in the years that I've interviewed you about your various different works, we don't really know a lot about you. And I know that, you know, people could say, well, we're going to talk strictly about his ideas, that's what's important, but clearly you're informed by a bunch of very important personal relationships. This book is dedicated, for example, to the two hamsters and 12 dogs, you say, who taught you the meaning of personhood. Can we hear more about your journey, how you come to know animals, and how you've come to develop these ideas and these types of interventions into animal thought?
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up not thinking anything about these issues. The only relationship I had with animals until I was in my late 20s was to eat them. And my father was in the food service and restaurant business and was, for a while, a meat broker. These were issues that didn't really surface for me at all. I believe when I was in college in the 70s, early 70s, I knew one, maybe two vegetarians. I didn't even know what a vegan was, actually, until quite a bit later. So these were not issues that were important for me or that mattered to me in any way. We didn't have any animals in the house growing up. My brother, had allergies. I had allergies as well. So we didn't have fur-bearing animals. I had turtles, and I had a snake or two, or a garter snake, whatever. But, I didn't really relate to animals except, as I said, to eat them. When I was in law school, I had the experience of visiting a slaughterhouse. A friend of mine who was a vegetarian took me to a slaughterhouse when I was in law school, and that profoundly upset me. And so I stopped eating flesh. I continued to eat dairy. As I said, at that point, and this was probably 1978, 79, it was a long time ago, and I don't believe at that point I had ever heard the word vegan. I didn't know what a vegan was. And I was not aware, actually, and this is not something, I'm not pleading ignorance here because I should have known, but I was not really aware that there were people in the world who didn't eat any animal products whatsoever. I mean, I thought basically if you didn't get some animal protein, you would die. And so I continued to eat dairy products. In the beginning, I ate fish for another year until I read something about fish being sentient. I stopped eating fish. When I graduated from law school and I was working in Washington, D.C. for Justice Sandra O'Connor, I was her law clerk, I met Ingrid Newkirk and Alex Pacheco, who had just started PETA. As a matter of fact, I believe when I first met them, they had just switched the name from another name. I think, in my recollection, I may be dead wrong about this, and somebody can ask Alex or Ingrid and verify it, but I believe originally it was called Justice for Non-Humans or something when Alex started it at George Washington University. But they had just switched the name to PETA, and they had really just started the organization, and it was a very small organization. I mean, there were probably at that time no more than a dozen members. I mean, it was a very small group. And I met them because when I was working for Justice O'Connor, I used to pick up a lot of stray dogs on Capitol Hill that were injured or whatever. And I used to call the Washington Humane Society, and Ingrid was the animal control officer of D.C. at the time. And I met her, we talked, and to make a very long story short, she introduced me to veganism. She gave me a book that was written by a guy named John Bryan, who's a British guy. It was called Fettered Kingdoms. And she gave me this book, and it basically talked about how if we took animals seriously, we shouldn't exploit them at all, including eating dairy products and everything else. And I read the book, put it down. It was 80 pages long. I read it in a couple hours, and I put the book down, and I haven't eaten a dairy product, egg, or anything else since. And it wasn't a gradual evolution. It was just I had never really thought about the issue. I didn't really understand the issue, and I wasn't aware that that was something I could do and not die. And so then I became very actively involved, first with PETA, but then with a number of other organizations. I worked as a lawyer. I did legal work for many of these organizations, primarily for PETA, but for a lot of them. And I did that, and I did it always pro bono. I never took money for it. When I finished my clerkship, I practiced in New York for a while, and then I went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I taught, and I was at Penn for 5 years, and then I came to Rutgers, where I have been for 20, and through all that time, my practice in New York and my time both at Penn and at Rutgers, I represented animal activists, animal organizations. And then in 1990, Anna Charlton, who is my life partner and colleague, we started the Rutgers Animal Rights Law Clinic at Rutgers, which was the first time, and I believe the only time, in the history of American legal education where students were learning animal rights theory at the same time they were working with us on real cases involving students that didn't want to dissect or vivisect, or people who wanted vegan food and couldn't get it in prisons or in other institutional settings. I do know a lot of the personalities involved. And one thing that I do want to say, because it one of the things I have found really unfortunate in the movement, and I use that term very loosely because I'm not really sure it is a movement, but in this phenomenon called the animal rights movement, any sort of criticism of anyone's position is immediately personalized and rejected as divisive or as a threat to unification or all sorts of crazy things. And you get sort of a cult reaction, the reaction that you get from a cult. You're not allowed to criticize, you're not allowed to discuss or have discourse. And it's always interpreted as being a personal attack on people. And Right now, I think Proposition 2 in California is a crazy idea. I mean, I can't understand why anybody thinks that that makes sense. And I've written some things about it. And what's interesting is what I write gets misinterpreted as an attack on the people at HSUS or whatever. And the thing is, I know Wayne Bissell well. I know Paul Shapiro less well than I know Wayne. And I certainly know many of the personalities in the movement. I disagree with them. I'm not making moral judgments about them. That's not my privilege, nor is it my interest. I'm not really interested in making moral judgments about anybody, whether they're at PETA, HSUS, or any place else. I just think they're wrong. And I have arguments for why I think they're wrong, and it would really be nice if once in a while people would sit down and discuss these issues substantively rather than turning them into personality issues. I mean, I was a guest on Bob Linden's show. I suggested that Bob invite Wayne Bissell on to debate Proposition 2, making it clear they could have whatever moderators, and if Wayne wanted to bring on, Peter Singer, or he wanted to, whatever he wanted to do is fine with me. And yet, they won't do that sort of thing. I mean, Wayne would not do it, but, it becomes personalized. It's like, well, if you oppose Proposition 2, you don't care about animals, or you're a bad person, or you're saying we're bad people because we're promoting Proposition 2. And I just wish that there could be some decent, intellectually rigorous discourse about an extremely important issue, violence. Violence towards non-human animals, which has all sorts of implications, and has all sorts of implications for human rights as well. If we would have some substantive discussions, rather than all of the drama, which is unfortunate because it stops discussion, and we don't have much because it's not really permitted. Once you say, look, I think Proposition 2 is a really bad idea, there is no substantive discussion. It's, you're a bad person because you don't like animals, or you're saying we're bad people because we're promoting Proposition 2. And the answer is no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying I think Proposition 2 is a bad idea for lots of reasons. And let's talk about those reasons. And if I'm wrong, tell me why I'm wrong. But let's not get into drama.
I think in many ways it becomes about identity rather than about the issues of the animals themselves.
What do you mean?
In the sense that people, I think, of course, within any movement there's going to be egos involved, and how people understand each other and themselves can... I've seen a shift, not a shift, but there's a tendency for people that it's about what is reflecting on them as a person rather than on the ideas.
I mean, why that happens is probably complicated and goes beyond the scope of a show that is less than several days long. But the problem, I think, is related at least in part. It may not tell the whole story, but a good part of the story is involved with the fact that these are large organizations. These are multi-million-dollar businesses. That is an empirical fact. This is not my opinion. This is an empirical fact. You can get online. You can get the 990s and the other documents of these organizations. I mean, you're talking about organizations that are bringing in millions and millions of dollars. And these are organizations that, by and large, don't have a very large vegan membership. So, these are organizations that are appealing to money for people who have very, very moderate views, and these organizations are not really interested in changing those people's views. They just want that money to keep coming in. So there's a problem. There's a real conflict, whatever the psychological explanation is, and I'm sure it's complicated, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think there's also a real clear economic incentive here that, discussion of issues presents an opportunity cost. It costs money to have a discussion about things rather than everybody rah, 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 rah around Proposition 2 or whatever other the welfarist campaign du jour is. If we're not all rallying around it and we're discussing it, well, that doesn't bring in money. If anything, that makes people wonder whether they want to support and send their money in. So I think that there's a real economic incentive involved as well. And I think that, one of the reasons why I think I've been able to stay outside of it for the time that I've stayed outside of it is because I don't make money from it. With my royalties for my books, I give that away. I don't even keep the royalties for my books.
We have to take a short break and do some ads. One of the things I wanted to come back to talk about, something I found really compelling in the book, was how carefully you go through some of the current welfare measures that have been taken that people have heralded as victories, and you do a very careful critique of those and show how those welfare measures are flawed and how they actually end up reinforcing the property status of animals and then the continued exploitation of animals. And I just thought the evidence was really interesting, and I was hoping we could go through some of that.
Sure, absolutely, Lauren.
Okay, great. And we'll come back with Gary Francione. We're talking about a bunch of things, but in particular we're talking about his book today, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation.